This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Before I introduce today's guest, I want to talk a little bit more about keeping our minds and eyes open about healthcare. It's an important issue. Ideology is defined as a closely organized system of belief, values, and ideas that we might have individually or as a society, not necessarily evidence-based. Not these ideas and beliefs may not stand up to critical scrutiny. So we need to keep that in mind. And what's happening with science, particularly in medicine, is we're learning that our medical ideology, the fact that we need antibiotics for all ear infections, that all back injuries or back pain need surgery. There's lots of examples that what our ideology is in medicine is not standing up to the data. So what's the point about healthcare? Well, we need to keep an open mind about what we believe is the correct answer to our healthcare problems and whether we really have a problem at this point. Along that line, I've come across another article I'd like to share with people, and it has to do with bankruptcy due to healthcare costs. It was published in the journal, the American Journal of Medicine recently. The author is James Dalen, a physician and a master's of public health. And he has looked at bankruptcy in 2007 in the United States. 62% of all U.S. bankruptcies were related to health care costs. This compares with only 8% in 1981. He states that that may be evidence that our current health care system, based on a for-profit, employer-based health insurance situation, is not working. He further somewhat editorializes in saying that, other countries are doing much, much better than us at a much less expensive way of doing things, and that other countries do have somewhat socialized medicine, but most do not. He points out that Medicare is not really socialized medicine in that the private sector is taking care of patients there and that no one has gone bankrupt under Medicare costs and that they seem to be doing a reasonably good job of taking care of patients. So, again, ideology is not necessarily evidence-based. We want to keep an open mind as we hope our representatives and senators back in Washington are doing as we grapple with the, I think, generally accepted idea that we need to be doing something different with our health care. On to a more happy topic, perhaps. Today, Abby Hensley is joining me along with Hillary Seitz, a physician, a PhD, early education instructor out at the University of Alaska. Abby Hensley is the executive director of Best Beginnings in Alaska, and we're here kind of talking about early reading and early literacy and its importance. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Abby, let's start with Best Beginnings and your history in this area. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, Best Beginnings really was born about 5 years ago when a number of people in the state, those associated with foundations and others, who came together and said, kids just aren't scoring as well as they should on their reading tests at third grade. And so they said, we really need to look at that. And they kind of backed up a little bit and said, well, according to the assessments that we have on record about children entering kindergarten, nearly half of our kids weren't fully prepared to meet the challenges of kindergarten. And so they had some other activity, a conference and some meetings, and then a task force called the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Task Force was formed and made a report in September of 2006 and came up with 11 recommendations that in order to deal with these issues. At that time, then, Best Beginnings really was pulled together as the entity to make those recommendations reality. And they were recommendations in three main areas. The first had to do with supporting parents as their child's first teacher and probably most important teacher. And secondly, it was about ensuring that there is high-quality early care and education programs that were accessible to families who wanted them. And third had to do with kind of the systems part and ensuring that all Alaskans really understood the value of investing in the early years, and also that we would develop in our state a comprehensive system of systems, actually, that would provide for more collaboration among all the parties involved, and that this collaboration would result in not only children being better prepared for school and then for life, but also that we would use the resources that we have in our state in a more effective and efficient way.
Abby, was this a statewide, or was this a national or regional? What is, or has it been emulated around the country if it started here? Tell us a little bit about that idea.
Our particular initiative, Best Beginnings, really is a statewide initiative, mm-hmm. and we describe it as a public-private partnership, so that our partners at the state, primarily the Departments of Health and Social Services and Education and Early Development, work with us on these issues, and then the private sector has come forward, both with members who sit on our board, as well as some fairly substantial contributions from some of our major companies in the state. But this effort is not just in Alaska. It really is a national effort. There's a much higher level of conversation about early childhood these days, and certainly at the national level, there's some legislation that's been introduced in a couple of different arenas having to do with early childhood. And many other states have developed these kinds of systems that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So it really is not something that started here. And, in fact, many other states have been farther along in the development of these particular kinds of systems and activities in Alaska. But luckily, we can learn from their mistakes.
Dr. Seitz, a question that comes to my mind is, although this seems to be well thought out and has a reasonable origin, are there developmental reasons for the idea that we should be focusing earlier and earlier in childhood and providing some stimulation, I guess, to the brain, if I be so crass as to say that?
Well, you started the conversation Abby, you started by saying that Best Beginnings was started when they started looking at test scores in third grade and realizing that they weren't up to par, or at least where they wanted them to be. And there are some things we know that can help support early literacy behavior, so that children can be more successful in schools. And so, we can work with families, we can work with parents, and we can start that process at a very young age.
Is it important to start earlier?
Well, I think it's something that's been done all along. I think maybe putting a value on it, mm-hmm. So that we know that this is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Times are changing. It's different now than it was 10 years ago, than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. I mean, when for many years, one parent did stay home with a child, and they talked to their child. They prepared things for their children, as far as, they worked together to prepare lunch together. They would go outside and take walks. They would go to the library. But families would stay home and do things with their children in a different way than things are happening now. Now, many children are in child care centers. Parents are becoming more and more removed from that process. And so I think we're putting a new value or having that value come back. And
Abby, that's not necessarily bad that parents aren't in the home as much, and if that's the case, then we have to somehow educate those people better who are doing the parenting, in quotes. Would you buy that, or does that bother you?
I think it's complicated. And I think one of the reasons that we are focusing so much more on the early years now is that we've learned through science about what happens with the brain and the brain development. And we've seen pictures of what happens with a child who has had adequate stimulation in the first 3 years of life, and in contrast with a child who hasn't. So I think as a society, we know more about what happens in the early years. I would say that virtually all parents want to do the very best for their children. And sometimes we just don't know what that best is. And sometimes we need other kinds of support and help. So whatever a parent needs to do in order to ensure that his child has adequate stimulation, I guess, and a nurturing environment, I mean, we want to be helpful with that. So whether it's providing books to children in the home, like the Dolly Parton Imagination Library that Best Beginnings has taken on a statewide basis, or supporting better education for those people, as you alluded to, those people who are caring for children during the day while families are engaged in work outside the home, or even thinking about the kinds of policies that we want to have in our state, which really are supportive of parents and families of young children.
Such as.
I think that
we didn't want to get into politics, right?
there are many things that employers can do, okay, and that many are doing to be supportive of families. I'm always gratified when I go to the I guess it's okay to name names here, to the Village Inn on Northern Lights, and see in the waiting area they have a couple of baskets of books for young children. So. Mm-hmm. You know, even that kind of thing says we value young children who come to our establishment.
Right, and there's a myriad of ways, small little things that can make a big difference is what I hear you say.
Yes.
Dr. Seitz, before we get too far into Best Beginnings, I want to hear a little bit about yourself and what you're doing, what your interests are at the university.
Well, I teach early literacy methods, and what that means is I work with early childhood educators, and some of them are currently working in child care centers or preschool facilities. Some are working in public schools as teaching assistants, and I help them understand the process of learning to read and help to support oral language development, and just so you understand how to work with young children. Mm-hmm. In addition to teaching actual literacy methods, I teach courses in how to work with families so that they can understand how to work, how to build a partnership, how to build a relationship, how to work within the systems. Not all schools and child care centers, are always friendly to parents. And so I'm helping to teach the educator to work with families better and to build on the strengths that the families have.
Yeah, so what I hear you saying is you're taking what we really know about what works and how to implement it and educate those people with kids or children early in life to make the use of their time most efficient. That gets to something we were talking about beforehand is if the brain is very good at learning something, it's better that we do it right than not do it correctly because the brain's not really good at forgetting how it did. And not that it's fait accompli, it's over, but it's much better to teach things correctly as we learn how to do that.
Well, just as Abby had said, we're learning more about science, and the child from birth to age 3 is actually the most active time in the brain. I mean, children are able to build more brain connections at that time. They're doing it faster than any other time in their life, and I think that's something new that hasn't it's kind of been around a little bit, but I think we're trying to use that information and help families and help child care providers or caregivers understand the importance of that and all the things we can do. And many parents are already doing all of these things, so in some ways we're just putting a name on that. But it's encouraging that process.
Well, Best Beginnings did a study 3 years ago now almost, and when we looked at what Alaskans knew across the board about early childhood. And one of the things that came out of that, which I think fits really well with our conversation here, is that while people felt like they knew that children weren't just blank slates, but that they were indeed born learning, they also didn't have a good sense of what that meant for the first year of life. And so that they were much more apt to say when a child was 2 or even 3, and could be in a formal educational program, that's really when education began. So what we at Best Beginnings have been trying to do with some of the PSAs on radio and television, some of the other kinds of things that we've been on our website and so on, is helping to fill that gap for people so that they know some of the quick, easy, inexpensive things that they can do that really can make a difference in that first year. And we don't have to wait. In fact, we shouldn't wait for our children to go to some organized program in order for that brain activity to be stimulated.
Let me take just a quick second to remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1. My guests today are Abby Hensley, Executive Director of Best Beginnings of Alaska, and Hillary Seitz, a PhD and Early Childhood Coordinator at the College of Education at UAA. If you have questions about early childhood reading, literacy, stimulation, this is a good time to give us a call, or you can also send us an email. Let me give you some contact information. You can dial us direct at 550-8433. Also, if you're outside of Anchorage, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And you can email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, please, at kska.org. And you can do that up until a little bit before 3 o'clock today. If you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. And none of us are going to be here. We'll be at home with our own families at that particular time. So take a chance or take the time now if you've got questions and comments and let us know. Tell us a little bit more specifically about Best Beginnings. You've mentioned a couple of projects or mm-hmm. things that you're doing. Flesh it out a little bit more.
One of the major activities that we've taken on fairly recently has been to provide statewide support for this Dolly Parton Imagination Library project. And what that is that a child from birth to age 5 can sign up for free in a community that is participating in Imagination Library and gets a free book in the mail every month. Now, the cost of that is about $30 a year, so it's really a very inexpensive way to provide reading materials that are appropriate for the age child that come every month in the mail. And we've been able to get some grant funding from Rasmussen Foundation, the Siri Foundation, and from ConocoPhillips, as well as from the state, to provide matching grants to communities to help them develop or expand their Imagination Library projects. In Tennessee, where this first started, where Dolly Parton is from, they've been at this for several years, and some of the evaluation that they've done has to do with asking kindergarten teachers what difference there is between children who come to them, to kindergarten, having participated in Imagination Library, and children who hadn't. And those kindergarten teachers felt that the children that they saw who had been receiving these books in the home and whose families had been reading the books with them were indeed better prepared for school, particularly better prepared to learn how to read. So that's one of the projects that we're engaged in. There's a lot of information on our website, bestbeginningsalaska.org, that would help parents with additional activities that they can use to do much of this brain stimulation. We also, through a grant from the Alaska Children's Trust and with some other support, provided some activity booklets in Spanish for babies, for toddlers, and for preschoolers that are free and can be obtained by coming to our website and getting an order form there. We also just recently helped the Department of Education and Early Development produce some of these educational activity guides in English. And so those are now available. And parents and child care providers and early educators can get those materials for free as well.
We have a couple of callers, and what I'm going to do is I'll come back to them after a short break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
The recorded rebroadcast of today's Line 1, Your Health Connection with Dr. Thad Woodard will repeat tonight at 8, and an archived copy will be available online at kska.org following today's live broadcast. KSKA is supported by listeners like you and Providence Alaska Medical Center. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of a stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Hi, this is Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about early childhood literacy, education, and I like to think about early childhood stimulation of that noggin that we've got up there that very early in life we need to be doing some things with, or otherwise it won't develop appropriately. Our guests are Abby Hensley and Dr. Hillary Seitz of UAA. I'm going to take a couple of calls right now, but I want to remind everybody you can reach us at 550-8433, locally 1-888-353-5752 if you want a toll-free number, and line 1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E at kska.org if you'd like to email us. That's line 1 spelled out all in one word. Mike, you're on line 1. What can we do for you?
Yes. What is your recommendation to start off education right for a 9-month-old? The reason I'm asking is my brother's a single parent, and I'm interested in helping him out and haven't really taken a very active role in his daughter's development.
Okay. So you've got a brother who's got a 9-month-old, and you want to make sure things are done right at his place. All right.
Yeah.
We'll see what we can give you some general guidelines.
Well, a 9-month-old would love to cuddle in someone's lap, and by cuddling and reading a book together, you know, you're actually building brain connections. When a child feels connected to a person, that actually sends endorphins into their body, and they're more able to learn how to read. They're more able to learn sounds. They're more able to learn, you know, just more able to learn, really. And you can start that at 9 months. You can start that at 3 months, but it's not too late. So I would say just start by talking to the child, reading to the child, hugging the child, and supporting your brother in his journey.
Well, Mike, I'd like to add to that. This is Abby. I think that when we're talking about books with 9-month-olds and even books with older children, we're really talking about sharing the book with a child. And it's, you know, it's not opening up a book and reading the words that are on the page and then turning the page and reading the words that are on the page and turning the page. But rather
more
to
of an experience.
Yeah, and an interactive experience. Even a baby as young as 9 months can, you know, pat the book, can hold it, can learn to turn pages, especially if they're board books that you're using, and really can have a really fun experience with that baby. You'd be surprised how soon that child will be either picking up the book on her own and holding it out for you to read, or chewing on it. Make sure you have safe materials. But there are lots of things that like that that you can do that are easy and cheap, and just talking with the baby. You know, one of the things that's a real benefit for us in our state is this tradition of storytelling that so many families across our state have. And just thinking about telling stories, maybe it's looking at photographs and talking about people who are in the pictures, and here's Grandma, and, you know, where's Uncle Joe, and where's Uncle Mike, that kind of thing. That doesn't cost a dime.
What do children at 9 months comprehend? Put some frame of reference relative to where they were in the first couple of weeks to months to where they may be at a year to 15 months. You know, one of the things I think it's important, I hope, is to know where kids are developmentally, mm-hmm. so that we're doing the right things at the right time.
Okay. Well, most people know at 9 months, that's about the time, the milestone of starting to crawl. So 9-month-olds are able to manipulate their body, and they're able to move. They're also able to think and to process, and they're forming their language systems inside their mind. They're probably not speaking them, or they're not oral yet, but they're processing them. They should be able to respond to their own name. So if you contact them or call them, they'll look up at you, or they'll make some motion that they recognize that you're talking to them. there's times even when some children can start to say, they'll be babbling and using some sounds. Some are even putting them to words like mama, mama, mama. It's typically a little bit later, around 1 year or 12 months, that they're starting to actually use certain words for certain things. But some nine-month-olds are starting to do that as well. So babbling, chains, other type.
Pulling themselves.
Yeah, they're starting to pull themselves up. They're developing, different sets of motor skills.
And I have to say, from looking at Best Beginnings website, Mike, that would be a good place to go to look. There's a couple of links, plus there's some very specific recommendations about different age groups that you can get to quickly.
That was BestBeginnings.org?
BestBeginningsAlaska.org.
I have another resource for you as well. Our state has recently put together the Early Learning Guidelines, and this is a document that you can actually receive for free through, I think it's the Department of Education and Early Learning. So if you go to their website, you can download it or receive a free copy. But what this book does is it goes through the different domains of learning, and they break it up into different age groups. So there'll be 36 to 60 months, or there'll be 18 to 36 months, birth to 18 months. And that's a kind of a general range, but it gives some indicators about motor skills, about cognitive development, about literacy development, about social development, and what have you, and types of things that you would expect to see. It's not meant to be an assessment to say, oh, no, my child got to 18 months and they're not doing these things, but it's meant to be indicators and a guideline for you. So that's another good resource.
And okay. One last thing, just to plug ourselves, if you go to kska.org/line1, we also have four links, one to the Best Beginnings website, but also three other links, one of which is has two links that help you find books that are appropriate for children between infancy and 9 years of age. So you can just hit that link and look for some information as well.
Hey, thank you very much.
Have a good day. Claudia, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. So I'm at a crossroads. My husband and I have raised our 5-year-old son bilingual all of his life. So his first language was Spanish, and once he started going to daycare, learned English. And so now he's pretty fluent in both, and depending how I introduce you, whether it's in English or Spanish, he can speak to you clearly in either.
So what's the problem?
The dilemma comes in that we were fortunate enough to get into the Government Health Spanish Immersion Program, and we're also fortunate enough to live in a scenic Park Elementary School area that has the once, maybe twice a week Chinese program. And so, you know, of course you want to prepare your child as much as you possibly can, and we're at that point where, I mean, do we put him into a program where he can fully learn two languages really well, or do we put him into a mostly English setting where, again, the only Spanish he's going to get is possibly at home, but then he'll be in at least exposed to a third language?
Great question. I love it. Dr. Seitz, this is for you, dude.
Yeah, I was hoping someone else would take it. It's tricky. I think it's going to come down to what you value the most for your child. If you want your child to be it depends, too, how much you're going to work with your child on the Spanish language. I'll tell you, it's pretty tough if it's only a parent that's working on it and you don't have the rest of the child's community around them to help them support it. It doesn't mean it's impossible, though. So if you really want your child to continue with Spanish, probably having them in a setting where they're going to hear Spanish in a number of different ways would probably benefit them more. On the other hand, you know, that's the time. Young children are ripe to learn new languages. It's much easier to learn them young than it is older. By age 10, it's very difficult. So,
what's your gut instinct? And then I got to ask real quickly, what's your husband's gut instinct?
that's sometimes where
the issue is. Yeah.
Well, see, my gut instinct is that, you know, I'm a Latina, I'm Mexican, but I'd love for him to learn Chinese culture. It's so different from what we have here in the U.S. and so different from what most of Latin America is. And I just think that it would prepare him more as a global citizen. And what greatness, right? But this was before I knew it was only once, maybe twice a week, you know? And then we're back to all English again. And right now we're going through thick times of Spanglish, meaning there's a lot of crisscrossing going along. Husband, he'd rather him go to Government Hill, only for the same reason that he's like, you know, the only Spanish he's getting right now is when he's with us, because we're Spanish only speaking home.
Right.
But it's that. I mean, everywhere else he's getting English. Everywhere else he's being reinforced with English. And he's, you know, I grew up the same way as my son in that I learned Spanish first and went to school and then learned English at school. And I guess my husband's a little worried that he may lose the Spanish because of the English is just going to take so much more. And that the Chinese, although is really awesome and great, there's not enough of it for him to really, you know, become fluent in it or really grow in it. So it'll be just exposure, and it won't be more than maybe if we picked up a third language and kind of started tossing it around. Right. As well.
Abby, you got any thoughts on this?
Claudia, I think like Hillary said, it's, you know, it's what's your gut instinct and how much intensity you want your child to have and how well prepared, how literate you want your child to be in both languages before you would add in it a third one. And it sounds like it would not be the same kind of intensity that you're looking for with Spanish. But I know you'll make the right decision for your child.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think you're doing a good job. And I don't know that there's an absolute precise answer. There's a lot of issues. And the reason I think we ask about your gut instinct is it depends a lot on the child. Are they enjoying it? What more about the school's location, ease for you to get there, the teachers. So trust yourself. You're doing a very good job of thinking this through. And I think you'll do the right thing.
I appreciate it. And just that's the plug, is that unfortunately for us, they're two really amazing programs.
Yep.
You know, both of them are just fantastic schools. They, you know, so it's hard. So we may have to just flip a coin at one point or another.
You got some lucky choices. And as I said, you're doing a very good job of thinking it through. And I wish we could be more specific, but I think you're going to do the right thing in the end run.
And by the way, thanks to Best Beginnings, I have used your Spanish, actually preschool and toddler and baby deals, and they're awesome. They're fantastic. So thank you so much for putting those up.
Well, thank you so much for the program.
Thank you. All right. Wojtek, you have a question for us?
Yes. Hello, everybody. What I have is I have an 11-month-old daughter, and her mom is speaking to her in one language. I'm speaking to her in the second language. And a month ago, I got in the tapes Your Baby Can Read in English. And so I'm Polish. Her mom is Russian. My question is, are we confusing our baby to the point that she's not going to understand any of these, or are we doing anything actually good to her, or just looking for some advice from you?
All right, so we got a Russian, a Pole, and an English. How can you read? Your question, as I understand it, are we going to make things more difficult, or is this good?
Yes.
All right. Who wants to grab this one?
I think the baby is lucky. They get to learn three languages at the same time. And this is the time to learn more languages. And it's really interesting to observe young children as they're picking up languages. As they talk to one parent that speaks one language, they can go to that language. And when they go to the next parent or another person that speaks another language, they can most learn how to move, how to manipulate, and go to the next language much easier than an older child or an adult can. So now is the time at 11 months. I don't think you're confusing. There will be times when the child will confuse the words and go between, but I think in the long run they'll learn how to sort it all out.
I would say that maybe this is a point of confusion for a lot of parents. There was a time where we were really concerned about children trying to learn two languages, that would slow them up. And I think if there's anything, we're exactly the opposite in our thinking now. There is no better time than that age to start introducing languages, and they can do it. I don't want to not say the right thing. Dr. Seitz or Abby, do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand,
but when we're showing her the tapes, she started responding to the English words, and our two different languages are totally different. So I just didn't want her to start learning English before she started learning Polish or Russian.
actually, I'm trying to think of the statistic, but I think it's around 9 months old. Up till 9 months, a child can actually hear and replicate all sounds from any language. Once they reach 9 months old, they start pruning. And so whatever they start hearing more, they're going to start making those sounds more clearly. So if a child hasn't learned Chinese by 9 months, they're not going to probably be able to do all the sounds. They may be able to learn some of them, even a five-year-old learning at Scenic Park. But it won't be the same as if they heard that sound frequently before a year's age. So it's actually to a benefit to hear it.
For your answer. Thank you.
All righty. Thanks for your call. Let me remind our listeners once again, if you've got questions or comments about early childhood education, teaching and learning, there's a couple of ways to get in touch with us before 3 o'clock today when we will go off the air. 550-8433 is our local number. 1-888-353-5752. Is our toll-free number, and you can email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Abby, you had mentioned also that you had received an email that you wanted to address that brings up some issues that may be confusing, and so I'll give you a chance to do that.
Thank you. There was a statement that is often made that reading to young children has been proven to be the single most important activity to ensure their success in school. And the person I got an email from pointed out that there was a long-term study by the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, that was cited that said that actually, while there was, if a child had at least 50 children's books in their home, he would score higher than a child with no books and so on. And the person sending me the email said that, you know, most people would look at this and say, well, more books, that child's parent must read to him more frequently. And actually, this data, as was described by this person, said that there really was no correlation between a child's test scores and how often his parents read to him. And so I started looking at, in fact, called on Hillary for some help as well, started looking around to see why it didn't make sense. If, you know, if a child had more books in his home, you'd think that the parents would be reading more to him and that there would be some result with test scores. And so what I found, and Hillary, feel free to chime in here too, is that it's probably, while it's hard to pull out one particular thing like that, and say, well, reading, you know, if you read 20 minutes a day, you would have these kinds of test scores. If you read 40 minutes a day, you would have these kinds. So, but rather than that, it's probably more beneficial to talk about the quality of the book sharing experience. As Hillary talked about earlier with a younger child, you know, it's the nurturing feeling, it's the being snuggled up and cozy, and just a parent spending time. There also is a fair amount of research that talks about the kinds of expressive language gains that children make when there's a rich interactive reading experience. When parents or whoever is reading with the child, sharing the story with the child, further describes what's happening in the book so that it's not just reading words that really have not much context. So they talked about some of this other research that I looked at said it was really the way that books were shared that matters. And so I think when we talk with parents and other adults about reading with kids, if we talk about the quality of the experience, the interactive quality, that probably makes more of a difference. Although I have to say that when one of our children was young, and, you know, we were always reading stories at night, and I would go through all this. What is this, and what do you think about that, and what will happen next, and all the things that, you know, you learn to ask children about. At least one time she said to me, "Mom, just read." So what that said to me was that, you know, she really was looking for that cozy, snuggled up feeling with just sort of hearing my voice, and it wasn't that she was so engaged in the story as it was the experience.
All right. Let me make a kind of a self a pat on the back, so to speak. The KSK is an organization that is also a media sponsor for Best Beginnings, and we do that because we believe strongly in supporting the mission to educate Alaskans about the importance of early literacy and learning so that all children in Alaska can begin to read and succeed early in school. With that, I'm going to take a short break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 on KSKA Anchorage. Tonight's edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection at 8 p.m. is recorded and is not accepting phone calls. Support for Line 1 comes from the Lake Otis Pharmacy. Walk in or drive through for medical equipment, support hose, and supplements. On Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, the pharmacy with a wheelchair on the sign. Children given positive attention and experiences during their early years are more likely to become smart, productive members of society. High-quality early education translates into higher graduation rates, better job readiness, and less crime and welfare dependence. So when you support a young child, you're supporting the economy. For more on early learning, visit bestbeginningsalaska.org. Early learning, it's everybody's business. This message comes to you from KSKA and Best Beginnings.
This is Line 1, Your Health Connection that you're listening to. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Abby Hensley, Executive Director of Best Beginnings of Alaska, and Hillary Seitz, a Ph.D. She's an Early Childhood Coordinator of the College of Education at UAA. If you've got comments or questions, you can reach us in two ways, by phone and one by email. Phone numbers locally are 550-8433. And a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Also, you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. I'd like to bring up an issue that is really hot in pediatrics right now, and that's television. Later, it's emails and text messages, but early in life, TV. What are your comments? What's good? What's bad? Should we not? How much?
This is Abby, and that, you know, those are all great questions. And I think that for many children, as they grow a bit older, we're really talking about screen time, not just television. My understanding is when the pediatricians group first put out their statement that that children under two should not watch any television, at that point there wasn't a lot of good research to back that up. I mean, it kind of goes back to what you had said earlier about ideology. And so I understand from Hillary that now there has been some, so she can share that if she wants to. But I think what we really need to talk about in terms of television or screen time is moderation, first of all, and then secondly, appropriateness. I worked for a long time with the PBS Ready to Learn project, beginning here at KAKM, and then with WETA in Washington, D.C., and then with PBS and the National Project. And one of the things that we tried to get across to families and to early childhood professionals was that we need to help children watch television purposefully and to get the most, especially for very young children, five and under. And so that if we're talking about watching television with that age group, we want to choose programming that is appropriate for that child. And PBS really does a good job with that of having fairly narrow age ranges so that you know that a program is appropriate for a child, say, 3 to 5. And then for a parent or other adult to find out what that program is designed to teach. And whether that matches up with your own child's temperament and interests and so on. And then to watch with the child. It's called co-viewing, and it's a way to both help answer your child's questions as well as to direct their viewing in a similar way as you would do with sharing a book. that you talk about what the child sees, answer questions, and then turn the television off and do something else, whether it's something that that is an extension of the learning from the program or just flat doing something else. Another thing, just real quick, that I remember from when I was here at KAKM, that one of our colleagues was visiting a particular part of town and talking to the parent of a young child, and she was thanking him profusely for the fabulous programming that was on KAKM in the children's lineup. And she said, I just don't feel like it's safe for my child to play outside, so I'm so grateful to have this television programming for him to be watching. So that's, I think, sometimes one of the reasons that families perhaps allow their children to watch more television than we might think is appropriate or valuable for that child. But to sum up, I would say choose carefully, let your child watch in moderation, and be really purposeful about what it is that your kids are seeing. And sometimes it means watching programs that you don't really like all that much as a parent, but you have to remember they're not designed for adults, they're designed for children.
Dr. Seitz, along this same line of thinking, besides TVs, there's now videos. And within the realm of videos, there are some being produced proprietarily purporting to help stimulate or develop a child's brain. Could we look at that seriously and ask you to make some comments on what we know about those kinds of programs?
Sure. Just like Abby was saying, you know, TV viewing or screen time in moderation is probably the key thing. The other key piece of this would be to know the actual child. I mean, each child is going to respond or react differently to screen time. So whereas one child probably could sit and watch a whole, you know, 30 minutes show or even a portion of one of these videos or these mm-hmm. programs, another child it may not be appropriate for. I know I have two children, and one of my children, from a young child, anything on the screen, it would grab her, and you couldn't talk to her. You couldn't even get her to look at you and make any eye contact, and it would change her whole behavior. Whereas my other daughter could sit and watch and entertain friends and talk and know other things going on. So each child is going to be very different, and I think so that would be the most important thing, is to know what is good, what your child needs and how they respond to situations, first of all. And really only the parent would know that, or parents know that best. But that being said, there have been actually several studies recently looking at the screen time of young children, particularly with infant toddlers and preschoolers. The American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended no screen time for children under two because they're saying that children that age really should be having face-to-face interactions, not in front of a flat box.
So it's not that they're not bad. It's just that they're ignoring or some more age-appropriate kinds of things.
Right. They found some negative findings from this.
Okay.
For infants that I believe it was 8 to 16 months, that sat for between 30 to 60 minutes in front of one of these programs, they actually found they had fewer vocabulary words in their repertoire as compared to children that didn't have that screen time daily. Mm-hmm. And they even were looking at younger infants where they were just looking at vocal events. During that time period, they could measure, you know, just the amount of noise that an infant might make during a 30-minute time period. And they put mics on and just recorded how many vocal events that infant had during that same sequence. And these were even interactive shows where the child supposedly would be doing things with them, and they had far fewer vocal events. Those were just sounds like babbling and things like that. So they have found there are different things with that. In addition to language is also kind of skewed a little bit. They're starting to look at different other issues for preschoolers, looking at grammar and comprehension and expressive oral language, and they're trying to make some connections to TV, although I don't know that research has been is complete at this point. They're finding some other things, too, because the types of programs, just like you were saying, the quality of the show also makes a difference, and who the child is viewing with. If a child is watching, you know, one of the PBS programs where they're looking at, you know, different concepts and different ideas, and a parent or somebody else or even a sibling or a peer is sitting there, and they're clapping and jumping and, you know, interacting with it, it's going to be a different experience than sitting back on the couch and just watching a two-hour movie. You know, and some of these shows, so it depends how involved the child child is and if there are other social interactions occurring at the same time. They're finding some more correlations actually with income levels and types of viewing. And so it may not actually be the screen time itself. It may be some of the other factors that are involved in that, such as mothers, they have fewer books maybe in their house, the children that are watching more TV. Or maybe they're having different quality of experience at child care centers because they can't afford to go to quality child care centers that have developmentally appropriate activities. So there could be some other factors related to that that mm-hmm. are causing some of these issues.
So those are called confounding variables. So sometimes when you're trying to study something, it's very hard to tease out the one thing you're trying to study and get rid of all the other potential influences mm-hmm. it may look like.
Right.
Causing that this one thing's causing. All right, we've got a couple of callers and an email and not a lot of time. I'm going to go ahead and take one of our callers again. Elizabeth, you're on line one.
Hi. I'm wondering what kind of programs do the kindergartens have in place for kids who show up that can read and they are going to get bored if their classmates are working on the fundamentals.
So I hear the question is, how do you handle diversity of readiness at kindergarten?
Right.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
So you're thinking in schools, how can you as a parent support it, possibly? Is that your question?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Hopefully, your child is in a classroom, where they have a teacher that understands developmentally appropriate practices, that understands young children. Yeah, the term young children actually goes up to age 8, and there is quite extensive research on how to use developmentally appropriate approaches for children in these ages. Most teachers know how to differentiate instruction. So what that means is you take a concept, and we're learning how to write words. Whereas some children already know how to write all their letters, they know all the sounds, they know how to put them together, they can put them into sentences, and probably some are still beginning or emerging kind of, where they're just starting to recognize different letters and different sounds and making connections. And a good teacher should be able to differentiate and maybe perhaps create groups, have different types of experiences. Sometimes even having an older child or a more advanced child support, a child that has that is still learning the concepts is a really good way for the older child to feel more successful and more competent in their own abilities. So it's not necessarily bad that a child that's competent is working with a child who knows less. That's how young children learn from each other. As a parent, there are many things you can do to support it. Get to know your child's teacher. I'd say that's the first thing. Talk to them. Get to know them. Build a good, strong relationship with them so that you can work with them. Sometimes teachers will send home additional work or different types of experiences that you can work on at home to support whatever level your child's at. So I would say that's probably the first thing I would do.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go ahead and take Mark. You're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hello.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Well, I just want to mention the work of Dr. Todd Risley. I'm an elementary school principal out in the Valley, and his work basically said that it's the amount of language that children hear from the ages of 1 to 4 that pretty much determine how well they're going to do in school. And we've had the honor of having Dr. Risley come out to our school. He just passed away 2 years ago, but he wrote a book that was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, and just wanted to add that to the conversation, how important that those early language experiences are, parents talking to their child. He, in his study, he defined that or was able to show his research that it broke down according to income levels, the amount of language mm-hmm. that they heard. So thank you.
Maybe we should mention Dr. Risley was a professor at UAA mm-hmm. As well. Any comments, further comments?
Well, one of the things that I took away from some of Dr. Risley's work, and the book was called Meaningful Differences, is this notion of business language rather than more or conversational language. So, for example, in some families, if a child dropped a spoon on the floor, the parent would say, "Pick it up." In another family, it would be, "Oh, you dropped your spoon? Well, let's get down on the floor under the table and pick it up. Oh, and now let's go to the sink and wash it." I mean, they would expand on the activity or the action that occurred so that that child really can hear more language and be more successful, as Mark pointed out.
So that's, it's very age appropriate. Nurturing is not the right word, but it's a different level of parenting understanding, it sounds like to me, when that's happening. And that's part of what you guys are all about, is trying to bring that mm-hmm. level of understanding to caregivers, parents, and so forth. That kind of say it.
Yes,
simply.
I think you did. And also to build on that, to ensure that it's not just people who have a young child in their home or are working with young children who understand this, but that really all of Alaska needs to understand the importance of this, so that we make the appropriate investments in the early years to be supportive of families, to ensure that there are appropriate learning environments for children, whatever parents choose.
We've got issues like kids that are adopted, or mm-hmm. parents die, there's a huge number of issues related to this early childhood. And it is not an all or none phenomenon, but it's a very, very important period in children's lives that needs to be well understood by the
Absolutely.
Broader populace. Is mm-hmm. that true?
Mm-hmm.
I like to always ask about myths. We've only got about 2 minutes. Myths or misconceptions? Anything jump to your idea, your mind when I ask about that?
Well, for me, it's this notion that children are born at sort of empty vessels that we need to fill up, uh-huh. And that whatever we pour in is what they will sort of get and take.
Mm-hmm. And expand on that. Why is that not true?
Because we know, as Hillary has talked about, different children learning in different ways. That is the kind of, children have all kinds of different experiences, and how they interact with those experiences has to do with what they learn.
Some are going to grow up to be English professors, and some of them are going to be baseball players. And
that's
they don't take it all in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a genetic construct underneath all of this.
Well, and we can talk about, no two children are born into the same family.
Right.
So, things change,
Yeah.
So we could say, well, I treated them all the same. Why didn't they all grow up the same? Well,
Dr. Seitz?
That there's one magic bullet. I think there are going to be a lot of different things we can do. And for just like you were saying, for some children, they're going to need to be held a lot more. Some children are going to need their space. Some children are going to need to explore on their own. Some children are going to need to have somebody hold their hand and help them explore it. So I think there's not one magic bullet.
And so it's really important for parents perhaps to go to some of these websites that are linked, to understand that there is tremendous variability in households and genetic underlayment to this, and that kids have different interests, different ability to stay focused, and all of this makes a big difference. But there's plenty of information about the appropriateness by age if you just want to do the little bit of diligence. And you have people like Dr. Heitz and Abby Hensley helping us all get there. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's been enjoyable having you here today.
Thank you.
Next week, you won't believe this, but we're going to be back, hopefully. And we'll be talking about prostate cancer. Each year we do talk about this just prior to some screening that's done locally. And we want to know what's new, particularly in helping men make the right decisions about diagnosis, and hopefully not having to make some decisions about treatment. But there are some very important principles to understand when we start talking about the treatment of prostate cancer in particular. So why don't you tune into Your Health and learn more next Monday, August 17th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.